This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. January 6th is a day that will live in infamy in the United States, but only if we, as Americans, truly accept what happened on that day and why the attack on Congress and the electoral process provided all Americans a crystal clear preview of what could happen next. For now, we know more, much more, about just how far Donald Trump and his administration was willing to go to overthrow the election. You remember that Trump rally in front of the White House on January 6th, the rally that preceded the surge to the Capitol that then led to the violent insurrection inside the building. Well, so far, the focus has been on what Trump said that day and how he inflamed the mob. But we all, regardless of party affiliation, we all should be paying closer attention to what else was said at the rally that day and by whom.
It is perfectly appropriate, given the questionable constitutionality of the Election Counting Act of 1887, that the vice president can cast it aside. He can decide on the validity of these crooked ballots, or he can send it back to the legislatures.
That, of course, is Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. On January 6th, Giuliani clearly telegraphed what Trump wanted Vice President Mike Pence to do: toss out the Electoral College results in several states. Giuliani also lied to the crowd, telling them it would be legal for Pence to throw the election.
Every single thing that has been outlined as the plan for today is perfectly legal. I have Professor Eastman here with me to say a few words about that. He's one of the preeminent constitutional scholars in the United States.
John Eastman is a former professor at the Chapman University School of Law in Orange, California. He retired from that position on January 13th, 1 week after the insurrection. Back in August 2020, he wrote an op-ed in Newsweek claiming that then-Senator Kamala Harris was not an American citizen. That, of course, is not true. On January 6th, Eastman shook Giuliani's hand as he stepped to the podium. He spewed a litany of false claims about ballot stuffing and voter fraud, all of which had been proven entirely untrue and therefore rejected by judges in approximately 60 cases that the Trump administration had tried to press in the courts after the November election. Nevertheless, Eastman further fomented the crowd.
And all we are demanding of Vice President Pence is this afternoon at 1 o'clock, he let the legislatures of the state look into this so we get to the bottom of it and the American people know whether we have control of the direction of our government or not. We no longer live in a self-governing republic if we can't get the answer to this question. It is the very essence of our republican form of government, and it has to be done. And anybody that is not willing to stand up to do it does not deserve to be in the office. It is that simple.
Hours later, on January 6th, rioters stormed the Capitol, called for the death of the Vice President of the United States, chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." They got as close as 100 feet to Pence as he fled the building. Well, now, thanks to reporting by Robert Costa and Bob Woodward, we know more about John Eastman. 2 days earlier, on January 4th, Eastman met with Pence and Trump in the White House. The meeting took place in the Oval Office. Eastman presented Pence with a plan, a memo in which Eastman outlined how Pence could stop the certification of the election. Quote, "The main thing here is that Pence should do this without asking for permission," Eastman wrote in the memo. According to Woodward and Costa, Donald Trump made clear his support of Eastman, telling Pence, quote, "You really need to listen to John." So put plainly, on January 4th, 2021, the then President of the United States met with the Vice President in the Oval Office of the White House. He and a lawyer offered the Vice President a memo, a plan to unconstitutionally seize control of the electoral certification process to stop the completion of the presidential election. And then 2 days later, when the Vice President refused to do that, a mob attacked the Capitol and threatened his life. So, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, what does all of this say to you?
Well, one thing it says is that it seems passing strange that at this late date there should be complacency about Donald Trump and the danger he poses. But there is, and one sees it in columnists. I'm thinking of David Brooks especially, who basically say, you know, Trump, yes, he was dangerous, and yes, something terrible could have happened, but he was incapable of rational planning. He's just too impulsive, just too wild, just too chaotic. There could have been no plan that originated anywhere near Donald Trump. We now know that's not true. There was a plan, a calculated strategy put to the Vice President 2 days before, as you say, a day that'll live in infamy, January 6th. And strangely enough, one of the people who helped to persuade the Vice President not to go along with this scheme was the former Vice President, Dan Quayle, who told him that it was just crazy, illegal. He couldn't do it. But the point is, there was a plan. It wasn't just Trump hype, you know, going on, maundering on about what he wanted to do. There was a scheme. There was a plan. There can be a plan again tomorrow.
Well, Jack, stand by here for a second, because I want to ask the same question of Neil Buchanan, who is a professor of law at the University of Florida Law School. And in fact, he co-authored a column that Eastman cited in that memo. We'll hear that story in just a second. But Professor Buchanan, welcome to you. And that same question to you. What does that 48 hours, essentially, that we just walked through, what does it say to you?
Well, hello. I would say that those of us who were not complacent all along suspected that things like that were going on behind the scenes. And I'm actually kind of amazed that, that Pence didn't go forward with it, not because it was a good idea. It's a ridiculous and unconstitutional idea. But because no matter how wrong the idea was, one of the most scary parts of it to me is what could have been done to stop it if he had simply gone rogue in the way that Eastman's memo said that he should have. And it's not like the Supreme Court would have walked into the chamber and said, oh, you can't do that right now. So the sort of immediacy and timeliness of it raised the fear that somebody in that position could have just said, well, try to stop me. Hmm. I'm amazed that Pence was not that person. I'm delighted that he's not that person. But Eastman's memo is a joke, but it would have given somebody the veneer of saying, oh, look, there's a law memo and I'm going to follow it now. And even if every competent lawyer in the world would have said that's a ridiculous memo, it could have just been the pretext for a coup.
That's how close we came, essentially.
Yeah.
Well, so this memo lays out essentially a six-step plan for Pence to overturn the election. And it includes throwing out results in some seven states because they allegedly had a competing slate of electors, but that's not true. No state
Correct.
Put forward a competing slate of electors. So, Professor Buchanan, tell us a little bit more about how you read what Eastman and Trump were proposing that Mike Pence do on the basis of what?
Yeah, so on the basis of lying, You point out, one lie, which is, claiming that there are disputed slates of electors when there were none. I will say, and you pointed out that I took a particular personal interest in this news when it came out, because in this memo, which surely will go into the National Archives, there's exactly one citation, and it's to a piece that I wrote with Professors Michael Dorf and Lawrence Tribe. We're still scratching our heads trying to figure out what Eastman thought was the purpose of citing our column, because all we said there was that an earlier leaked scheme from the Trump camp was to imagine a scenario in which Pennsylvania was the only state that stood between Trump and Biden, and that it had been officially called for Biden. What the Republicans were saying what the Trump people were saying at that point was that if they could just knock out those votes so that Biden's Electoral College total was below 270, the magic number that everybody had been aiming for, that was going to throw it into the House of Representatives under this provision under the 12th Amendment. And our article merely said, this wasn't on some deep constitutional theory. It was just the clear language of the 12th Amendment says no. The only time it goes into the House is if neither person gets a majority of the votes, of the electoral votes. And Biden would have still had a majority of the electoral votes. Now, what Eastman did in his memo...
Well, actually, Professor Buchanan and Jack Beatty, can you just hang on here for 1 minute? Because I do want to hear, of course, what your analysis of what Eastman said in that memo. Just got to take a quick break. So we'll be back in about 90 seconds. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we are trying to understand just how close the United States came to a true constitutional crisis on January 6th and whether the country is actually still in that constitutional crisis. I'm joined today by Jack Beatty. He's On Point's news analyst. And Jack, I promise I'm going to come back to you in just a second here, but Neil Buchanan is also with us. He's professor of law at the University of Florida Law School. And Professor Buchanan, you were walking us through what the Eastman memo, again, that memo that we now know was presented to Vice President Mike Pence in the Oval Office on January 4th, suggesting how he might throw the Electoral College count. What did the memo layout you were about to tell us?
Yes. So the idea was that in the column that he cited that I was a co-author of, if a number of electoral votes were thrown out for some reason, our analysis was that Biden would have still won because he would have had a majority of the electoral votes that were actually cast. Now, what Eastman said was, rather than saying, okay, that's a good point, he said, not in these words, he said, basically, challenge accepted. All that means is we need to throw out more electoral votes. So that's where he came up with 7 states worth rather than 1 state. And his argument was essentially that if we can get Pence to throw out 7 Biden states electoral votes, then Trump would have a majority of the remainder. And under the Buchanan-Dorf tribe analysis, Trump would win. Now, that would have been true if it were legitimate to throw out those 7 states, because it is the 12th Amendment really is a majority vote rule. in the Electoral College. And that's why the rest of the memo is the more interesting part, because the rest of the memo essentially just says Vice President Pence should have lied about disputes in those other seven states, and then said that he alone has the power to declare them all invalid, and then only recognize the votes in a way that would have had Trump and Pence himself winning re-election.
Yeah. Well, Jack, in the memo, Eastman writes that the vice president should determine that the ongoing election challenges must conclude before ballots can be counted and should just adjourn the joint session of Congress. And then he says, echoing what Professor Buchanan was pointing out before, this Eastman memo literally says, we're no longer playing by Queensberry rules. The main thing here is that VP Pence should exercise his 12th Amendment authority without asking for permission. What do you think about that, Jack?
Marcus of Queensbury rules. Well, of course, the rules are not in Marcus of Queensbury, who established the rules for boxing. It's in, they're in the Constitution. But of course, we've seen, we saw throughout the Trump administration in terms of rhetoric and sometimes action, how little regard the president had for the Constitution, how little knowledge he had of it. And so this is quite in keeping with his predisposition about the Constitution. You know what was remarkable to me, though, about the Eastman memo, just as a document, when it was publicized first last week, Media Matters for America documented that the evening newscast that night, ABC, NBC, CBS, not one word about this. The next day on the on those morning shows, which are watched by millions of people, not one word about this. The only mention for the first 2 days was by late night comedians on the variety shows. Mm. They did mention it. And in their story on this, the Times, according to Margaret Sullivan and the Post, dropped mention of the Eastman memo deep down in a sweeping news analysis. Why? Why did the networks and even, you know, the Times, as far as it minimized it, why did they do that? She quotes one theory, which is that Trump has so flooded the zone with anti-democratic comments and professions and actions that we're just numb to it, and media people are numb to it. And the second reason she had is she quotes from a former network producer who hypothesizes that the reason they didn't pay attention was, quote, after all, it didn't happen.
Oh.
That's pretty scary.
Well, I mean, it didn't happen by a hair, essentially, right? I mean, that's what we have to come to grips with in this country. And it's not only that it didn't happen, but the question is, could it happen in the future? I mean, John Eastman himself in this memo says, quote, I should also point out that we are facing a constitutional crisis much bigger than the winner of this particular election. Okay, and this is in what he and Trump presented to Pence in the Oval Office of the White House. So, Neil Buchanan, I mean, do you see in the existence of this memo evidence of, you know, the roadmap for a future plan regarding the next election in the United States?
Well, that's an interesting question to try to answer, because the memo is so silly that all you can do to describe it is that it purports to lay out six steps. The steps themselves are they sort of blur together, and some of them are irrelevant. And so it's not the content of the memo that scares me. It's that there are people who are willing to, as you were saying in the introduction, you know, plan. This was not a chaotic Trump just going on the stump and saying, you know, whatever he came up with. There were people who were going to be willing to stand up and wave a piece of paper around and say, look, I have this memo saying that Trump won, and essentially say, try to stop us. Now, in 2024, unless something very unusual happens, Kamala Harris will be the vice president. Doesn't raise the possibility of having Eastman hand her the memo and getting her to do what he would want her to do. I want to ride on the point that bad legal analysis is bad legal analysis, but it can be very effective political cover for what amounts to just an out and out bloodless coup, or in this case, almost a bloody coup.
So, Professor Buchanan, what then is your assessment on the health and state of democracy in the United States?
Well, I wish I could bear good news, but starting right around the time that Trump became the presumptive Republican nominee in 2016, began writing a long series of columns in which I argued that the end of constitutional democracy was visible, that the rule of law was under threat. I was actually one of the people who thought that Trump really would not leave in January 2021, no matter what. I had the picture in my mind of him essentially just saying, you know, I'm the one who's in charge of the military. There's the old line from Joseph Stalin: "How many troops does the Pope have?" Right? And I was imagining Trump doing that. So I was delighted that we got a reprieve, and Trump actually did leave 14 days after the insurrection. I delighted and completely surprised. So going forward, I think that the state of democracy is not threatened by the possible repeat of what happened this January 6th, either the peaceful part or the violent part. To me, the bigger concern is that Republicans are putting in place the pieces necessary to not even get to the point where they have to worry about the counting exercise in Congress on January 6th, because they're so effectively suppressing votes. And if they were to retake both houses of Congress by January of 2025, they have two election cycles in which to try to do that. The Congress could do what the majority of House members of Republican House members tried to do this past January, which is to just say every Democratic state is every state that went Democratic in the 2024 election is hereby deemed invalid, and whoever the Republican nominee is wins. And they could do that. They would only have to do that if all of their other suppression efforts had failed. And unfortunately, I don't think that they're going to fail.
So you're saying, Professor Buchanan, that we have to be willing to imagine the unimaginable.
Yeah, I've been doing it for 5 years. It's not fun.
Well, Neil Buchanan is a professor of law at the University of Florida Law School. Professor Buchanan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm going to bring in a couple of other legal scholars here in just a second. But, Jack, I wanted to hear from you again, because Professor Buchanan is rightfully expanding the lens of our focus here to not just the Eastman memo, which is the latest part. It's the latest piece of this puzzle, but to the broader changes in the very fabric of how our small d democracy is supposed to work in this country. And I just wanted to hear from you on that.
Well, yes. I mean, he's alluding to the panoply of laws passed, several states, but certainly proposed in as many as 20, that would, in one way or another, limit the vote, suppress the vote, perhaps even lead to election nullification. And one element of these laws, one law in particular in Texas, essentially enables vigilante behavior around polling, around polling stations. It would allow poll watchers a good deal more freedom than they've ever had before to keep a close eye on the vote, to videotape voters going to the polls. And now, whether they could be armed or not, I don't know. But of course, Texas, I think pretty much everybody has a gun anyway. So, and what's the danger of this? Well, the danger of it is that, first of all, people won't turn out not wanting to be videotaped voting. The second danger is that it will produce violence, that people will resent it and say, wait a minute, I don't want you taking my picture. I don't want you here with guns, that there will be trouble at the polling stations in Texas. And not only in Texas, 20 other states have introduced similar laws, not all passed, and that violence will precipitate an action by the Texas governor, perhaps even to send in the National Guard or police to suppress it. And there we're in the situation where voter suppression turns from legal matters to force. We're, you know, just closing down polling stations. The point is, we're going to see a preview of this kind of front line, in the trenches voter suppression real soon, starting in the next year's election. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to bring in a couple more democracy experts into this conversation. Anna Gujmalabhusa joins us. She's professor of international studies and director of the Europe Center at Stanford University. Professor Gujmalabhusa, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And Suzanne Mettler is with us as well. She's the John L. Senior Professor of American Institutions at Cornell and co-author of Four Threats, The Recurring Crises of American Democracy. Professor Mettler, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I was wondering if you might give us your first take on, let's just stick with the Eastman memo for a second here, because I think a lot of people are still trying to wrap their heads around it. I mean, is this a fifth threat to American democracy?
Well, no, actually, unfortunately, it fits right into the four threats that Robert Lieberman and I write about in our book. We started this book, you know, about 5 years ago, wanting to know, was American democracy really in danger? And we learned from scholars who study democratic deterioration around the world that there are four things that can really endanger it. And they are high levels of political polarization, a conflict over who belongs as a member of the polity, which may be, you know, invoking racism and nativism. The third threat is high economic inequality. And the fourth is executive aggrandizement, or the growth in power of the nation's top leader. And these threats have waxed and waned throughout American history, and they've combined in different ways. When three of them were present in the 1850s, it led to the Civil War. When three were present in the 1890s, it led to the disenfranchisement of millions of African-American men for decades to come. Today, we have all four threats present, which we've never had before, all present at a high level. And what I see in this memo is, in particular, the partisan polarization that is happening today, which, and the main characteristic of it, is a Republican Party, which, although it's one of our two major parties in the United States, it's increasingly willing to override democracy in order to stay in power or to claw back power. Mm. And, you know, that's what's really going on in this memo, is this raw partisanship and quest for power, no matter what, running roughshod over democracy. Mm. I mean, democracy is supposed to be the basic rules of the game that both parties are willing to play by. And when we step away from those, it's a really dangerous situation.
Well, Professor Gujmalabhusa, we've just got a minute before our next break here, but I wanted to give you a chance to follow up on that, and then we'll pick it up on the other side of the break as well. But go ahead.
Thank you. I totally agree with what Suzanne is saying, and I think what's really worrying here is that this is part of a broader pattern of undermining trust in democracy itself. So what we're seeing is basically a shift from a rule of law to the desire to rule by law. And the questioning of the integrity of the most fundamental of democratic institutions, our elections. And both of us are deeply troubling because in other places, they've led to the erosion of democracy that's quite significant.
Well, we'll hear more from all three of you when we come back. We're talking about what more we're learning in what regarding what happened on January 6th and the insurrection on the Capitol in the days preceding that, and what kind of preview it's giving us regarding the future of American democracy in the next year, the next 2 years. We'll have more. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're facing the question of whether America is in a constitutional crisis right now, based on what more we've learned over the past week about what happened not just on the 6th of January and the insurrection on the Capitol, but in the days and weeks preceding that as well. I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. Suzanne Mettler is with us. She's a professor of American institutions at Cornell University and co-author of Four Threats, The Recurring Crises of American Democracy. And Anna Gujmalabusa is with us as well. She's a professor of international studies and director of the Europe Center at Stanford. And Professor Gujmalabusa, I'm going to come to you in just a second here. But again, to give people a more complete picture of the more that we know now regarding what happened between basically the first of this year and January 6th. We talked about the day of the insurrection and the rally preceding that. We talked about the January 4th meeting that happened in the Oval Office with John Eastman, the lawyer, who presented this memo to Vice President Pence about how he could overthrow the Electoral College count. That meeting also with Donald Trump, then President Trump, in the Oval Office in that meeting, giving his strong approval to the plan, to Pence here. So that was January 4th. Just 2 days before that, on January 2nd, Donald Trump made a call, you might remember, to the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, amongst others. There were several others on the call where Trump insisted, and we're going to hear a moment from that call because it was leaked to The Washington Post, where Trump insisted that there were more than enough votes to flip the results of the election outcome in Georgia.
All I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country.
So Trump was focused on finding, quote, finding 11,000 votes, but there was much else that he said, and something in particular he said on the call while his lawyer, Cleta Mitchell, addressed their beliefs that an additional audit of the Georgia results was warranted.
We haven't even gotten into the Dominion issue. That's not part of our case. It's not part of, we just didn't feel as though we had any way to be able to develop.
No, we do have a way, but I don't want to get into it.
Exactly.
Because we found a way in other states later, excuse me, but we don't need
right.
it because we're only down 11,000 votes, so we don't even need it.
Right.
I personally think they're corrupt as hell, but we don't need that because all we have to do, Clayton, is find 11,000 plus votes. So we don't need that. I'm not looking to shake up the whole world.
Now, we still don't know exactly what Trump was referring to about the that he was talking about, or he's not looking to shake up the whole world with that, whatever it was. But recall, that call happened on January 2nd. January 4th in the Oval Office, there's the memo, the Eastman memo handed to Mike Pence, and Robert Costa and Bob Woodward are the ones who have uncovered that memo. And here is what Robert Costa said on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
The legal side of the Trump team were trying to convince the vice president and his team to decertify President-elect Biden's victory at the time, essentially walk away from the lectern on January 6th. And that could have been a constitutional crisis.
Well, Anna Guatemala-Busa, you were talking about how with each additional piece of this puzzle, a bigger picture is coming clear. And what is that bigger picture?
I think the bigger picture is of a would-be autocrat who was narrowly prevented from a coup. You know, what the Eastman memo shows, it's a clear example of an attempt to rule by law rather than the rule of law. And that's something that autocrats have widely done. You know, it's the idea that, you know, the rule of law should constrain arbitrary action. Rule by law enables that kind of arbitrary action. And people like Putin in Russia or Orban in Hungary have done exactly this, use the law in order to target their opponents, to cement their hold on power, and to basically ensure the sort of deepening autocracy in their countries. And I think both the Eastman memo and I think the broader sort of attempt to discredit elections is very much part and parcel of that project.
Suzanne Mettler, let us again try to bravely imagine the unimaginable here. But if nothing changes legally or politically between now and 2022 or 2024, what could the potential outcome be? What path is the country headed down?
Well, you know, there are ways in which democracy is really strong today, and there are ways in which it is very vulnerable. And so in terms of strength, it's important to point out that despite Trump's great efforts to challenge the results of the 2020 election, that election administration worked extremely well in the United States. And frankly, our election administration is stronger now than it's ever been. You know, there was plenty of time in the American past where there was stuffing of ballot boxes and all kinds of chicanery over elections and machine politics, et cetera. But for the past several decades, that's become stronger and stronger. And it's kind of like a light hit under a bushel. Most Americans don't realize how well our elections are run. And then the other component is the courts. And, you know, including lots of judges that have been appointed by Trump himself, they threw out these dozens of legal challenges that the Trump campaign tried to bring forward. So in those ways, you know, democracy is strong. Our institutions are strong. What's weak right now and what's so worrisome is the connection between citizens and government. And you have, you know, for Americans generally these days, there is distrust in government. And that has grown over many decades. And, you know, Americans these days, Democrats and Republicans, don't agree on much of anything, but they agree on not trusting government. And that's very dangerous because it means that people, that there's a loss of legitimacy for things like the value of our elections, even when they're running well. But then the other problem is, of course, as I was saying earlier, this Republican Party that is willing to seek power at all costs. Mm. And so, you know, we have to keep our eyes on both of those things, both the strengths of democracy, but also these weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And it's, you know, this party that is willing to, you know, seek to gain power or to maintain power, even if it means running roughshod over free and fair elections and respecting the results of elections and the rule of law, as Anna is saying, that's really dangerous.
Right. You know, so Jack, I really appreciate Professor Mettler's wise perspective giving here in this moment, because I will admit my heart rate is rather accelerated when I think about the future of American democracy. But I also wonder that, I mean, the very strengths of the electoral system that she described is that are not those strengths that are under concerted attack in various states and by the lack of passage of protections for voters and voting at the federal level.
Indeed. And the silence of the, establishment of what used to be establishment Republicans in the Senate, in the Congress, is, as they say, deafening and incriminating. Robert Kagan, in a very influential piece in The Washington Post, really argues that the Mitt Romney, the Susan Collins, the people that voted to convict Trump on impeachment, and the House members too, who voted to impeach him, that they're making the running for the radical forces who are doing just what you're saying, tearing away the protections in democracy, the things that made last year's election the most secure in our history, according to the Trump's own election expert in the Department of Homeland Security, and that they're making the running. They're pretending that the real issues are Democrats spending and the going on about, mishandling Afghanistan, when all the time off stage in these states, a kind of coup is being prepared, and they're not saying anything. They haven't made any comment on the Eastman memo, for example. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're pandering to something here, and that is something that Larry Bartels, the Vanderbilt political scientist, previewed on our program last year. He did a very important paper called Ethnic Antagonism Erodes Republican Commitment to Democracy. And just as Professor Mettler says, it's this unwillingness of Republicans, many, to admit other people into the polity that is driving their, and as he calls it, erosion, to their lack of commitment to democracy, and worse, their willingness to countenance force, quote, to preserve the traditional American way of life. He found that a majority of Republicans, this was, well, January of 2020, agreed with that. And now we have a University of Chicago poll saying 8% of Americans would justify the use of force to restore Trump to office.
Well, Anna Grzmalowska, I will feel compelled for many years onward to as I keep saying, force ourselves to imagine the unimaginable so that we as a nation can prepare for it. So looking across history and different and other countries' sort of descent into autocracy, is there a particular example that you feel is close to what the United States is undergoing now? Is there anything analogous?
There's certainly elements that look very familiar. The kind of erosion of the faith in the integrity of elections, the willingness to lie about the elections and about the results, the sort of undermining of local institutions, all of those aspects are familiar. I think what makes the United States unique is that unlike many other countries, at least as Suzanne pointed out, on the federal level, the formal institutions of state are pretty solid. The Congress, the courts, the IRS or the CDC or the Department of State are all sort of holding fast. I think the real problem is what's happening on the level of informal institutions, where we are undermining faith in democracy, where we are now, some voices basically think the opposition is illegitimate and the free media ought to be basically never to be trusted. And I think what really worries me, exactly as Jack says, it's what's happening on the state level. Because here, the voter suppression is one thing, but the fact that we're eroding checks and balances and state legislatures will now be allowed to certify elections is deeply worrying. Mm. And all of these elements have happened in the past. When you put them together in the way that Suzanne was saying, that becomes a very dangerous picture.
Yeah. Professor Grzmalowska, I will remind our listeners that you are the person who brought to this show a phrase that we've turned to again and again when we were talking about Hungary, that if you squint hard enough, it looks like a democracy, right? Squint hard enough. And I wonder if we're headed down that path in this country. Now, Suzanne Mettler, David Frum in The Atlantic wrote a couple of months ago, this, quote, in the United States, the forces of legality still mobilize more strength than their Trumpist adversaries. But those who uphold the American constitutional order need to understand what they are facing. Trump incited his followers to try to thwart an election result and to kill or threaten Trump's own vice president if he would not deliver on Trump's, quote, crazy scheme to keep power. And then David Frum suggests at the end of this piece that it is time to use what he says, the F word, not the expletive, but fascism in order to accurately diagnose what may be coming in the United States. What do you think?
You know, I think that this is really hard for a lot of Americans to think this way, because we think of the United States as kind of immune from democratic backsliding and deterioration. But what I would say is we need to look at our own past. So when I was watching the events of January 6th, it was taking me back to 1898 in North Carolina. So, you know, the in the South at that time, the Democratic Party was the party of white people, and newly enfranchised African Americans who, you know, for a few decades then had been practicing voting rights were Republicans. There was the rise of populists. The Populist Party at this point in time, an agrarian movement. And they learned that if they worked together with the Republicans, they could actually beat the Democrats. So they would run this fusion ticket. They did that in North Carolina in the 1890s. They started beating the Democrats. So the Democratic Party said, you know, this can't be. We can't go on like this. We've got to seize back power. And so you had all of these elements then of strong partisanship, a party that was definitely trying to restore its cultural heritage as white supremacist in that area, and high economic inequality. What they did was they staged a coup d'etat in the city of Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898. There were all of these white men in paramilitary groups who were brought together on the morning of November 10th. They marched from the city armory, went to the office of the Black-owned newspaper, burned it down, went into Black neighborhoods, killed lots of people, sent leaders of the community out of town on the train. And by the end of the day, the Democratic Party leaders had taken the resignations at gunpoint of all of these elected leaders and installed their own in their place. This brought out into the open what was happening all over the South at that time. And it led to poll taxes and literacy tests, which were then instated and scaled back voting rights for 60 years to come.
We just got a couple of seconds. Yeah,
this was major backsliding. It happened in the United States. And so we're not immune from this. And there are too many parallels between that time and now.
Well, it makes me think that perhaps if there's anything that the American people can do, it's to press on, say, Senators Romney, Collin, Murkowski, those who were brave enough to vote on the impeachment, to vote for voting rights, to the protection of voting rights. That may be a start. Well, Suzanne Mettler, professor of American institutions at Cornell University and co-author of Four Threats, The Recurring Crises of American Democracy, and Anna Gujmala-Busa, professor of international studies and director of the Europe Center at Stanford University, and Jack Beatty, of course, On Point news analyst. Thank you all so very much for joining us today. Well, after the weekend on Monday, we're going to be taking a look at another major issue in life right now, the international chip shortage. It's made it harder to buy things like cars, smartphones, game consoles, kitchen appliances. Has that happened to you? It happened to Jackie in Connecticut.
I was in the market for almost a year to buy a new smartphone, a Samsung, and there just was nothing available.
Sound familiar? Or maybe you're a business owner who's been affected by the shortage. Are you having issues with inventory or production? And specifically to our KPCC listeners in Los Angeles, where a lot of these goods come in, We want to hear from you if you work or know people who work at the Port of Los Angeles or the Port of Long Beach, where ships have been backed up for days and weeks. What have you seen and experienced? What has it been like? Call us with your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.